I've spent many years of my life thinking about mind and consciousness and morality and God and meaning and purpose. And not only thinking about it myself, but speaking with lots and lots of people about it, reading about it, watching other people struggle with the questions. And often I find even very smart people having not really thought through things in a systematic way, it seems to me. They just kind of leap to conclusions on all sides, on believing and unbelieving sides. And I've been trying to kind of systematize how someone might go about setting up a structure upon which to start thinking about these issues. I was taking a jog this morning and I came up with this as a kind of a beginnings of a structure. So start off by talking about mind and qualia or consciousness. I'm going to use qualia and consciousness kind of synonymously. Qualia means the experience that you have of something, what it means to be a person, your first person experience. Mind, you could think of mind as not necessarily requiring consciousness, right? Even when you're unconscious, your mind is doing things, or your brain is doing things anyway. So let's think of, just for this point of this discussion, let's think of mind as just sort of this calculating, responsive thing, a process, and consciousness or qualia as your subjective experience of mind. And realize that even at its best, your subjective experience of your mind is actually only a small portion of your mind. There's a lot of things that go on in your mind that you're not consciously aware of. So it's very easy to imagine mind without consciousness, at least it is for me. So what qualifies as mind? Obviously, we all believe we have minds. It's pretty. Now, of course, you get the problem of solipsism. I know that I have a mind. I don't know that you have a mind. That's a developmental thing that people get out of when they're like two, I think. And then they go to college and they go revert. But anyway, we all know that we have a mind and we believe that other people have minds. And we can extend that out somewhat to apes, to smarter animals like pigs, ravens, dogs. It's relatively easy to think of them as having a mind. Remember, I'm not talking about consciousness, just talking about mind. And we can go, fairly far down the scale, if you will. Rats and fish and so forth, they all have some kind of mind. They calculate, they respond. But it gets even weirder than that, because trees have something like a mind. And I know that sounds stupid, but it really is true that trees communicate with one another through this, I think it's called the mycelial network. It's this network of fungus underground. I'm not sure I have the details right on this, but this is basically the outline of it. That trees are able to communicate with neighboring trees, with trees sometimes fairly far away. They're able to communicate things like, I need potassium, or this response worked against the moths this spring, or this tree over here is in trouble. It's fascinating, and there's developing research on the kind of communication that goes on between trees and through this network. And there's also thought that the network itself communicates and does different things, that the network allows itself to be used by the trees, but when the network itself gets threatened, it's willing to cut off the trees and let them all die. So there's something like mind going on with trees and fungus and this underground weirdness. And that reminds me of a book I listened to a little while ago. This is one of those books where you don't know if it's crazy or if it's genius. You don't know if it's cutting edge or if it's just some sort of lunatic speaking, and I don't know the answer to that question. But it was about the early life forms, back in the Precambrian. And if you don't know, the Cambrian explosion, I think it's 600 million years ago, all of a sudden there were all these fossils of various kinds of life forms that were fairly complex. I mean, not complex like a rat, but complex like a jellyfish. Complex, more complex than just single cell critters. And before, in the Precambrian, there's evidence of these huge, like, mats of bacteria or other kinds of things. And there's some question of, what was the benefit of these things living in some sort of collective? Why weren't they just individual cells floating around doing their own thing? Somehow there was a benefit to them of living in some sort of collective, that there was something, perhaps something somewhat analogous to what we see is with the trees and the mycelial network and all that. Maybe there was some sort of communication going on among these mats of bacteria. I'm not saying that they were writing Shakespeare or anything, just that there was some level of communication across this network. So I think thinking of those things kind of expands, in some sense, our concept of where mind might exist. But we can go a little further, and that's into hive minds, like ants and bees. Now, what exactly is going on there? Is it just every ant and every bee is, a good soldier, sir, yes, sir, goes out and does his thing? There is this weird concept of at least the possibility of mind, something like mind, being somehow almost decentralized across these different critters. And I'm not saying that that's true. I'm just saying that's something you can ponder as, if a bunch of bacteria living in a mat of bacteria can have some kind of mind going on, some kind of calculation, some kind of decision making. Let's just leave it at that. Calculation and decision making. Well, there's obviously some sort of hive calculation and decision making. And how does that happen? Is it just the queen making the decisions and passing on orders, or is there some sort of hive mind in some weird sense that is spooky and I don't understand it? And I'm not saying that there is such a thing. I'm just asking, is it possible? Now, of course, that also in the modern age, that raises questions about computer systems and can computers have minds? Obviously they have make decisions. They have information, they make decisions. So in some sense, I don't want to talk too much about computers, but in some sense, computers have minds in the way I'm talking about, not consciousness or qualia, just a mind. Okay. So there is this weird calculation and decision making and action that goes on in the natural world in all kinds of different ways, not just contained inside a raven's skull, but also in trees, in bacteria, in other kinds of things. Okay, so now let's go back to consciousness, qualia, our own consciousness, our own experience. And that's sort of the, not only are you cold, but you're miserable about being cold, right? Not only are you sad, but you're sort of able to reflect on being sad. You're aware that you're sad. And we can once again kind of go down the scale. Apes, pigs, ravens, dogs. I'm not sure if smarter a pig or a raven. Ravens are pretty doggone smart, but you get the point. It's easy to imagine consciousness, qualia, going down the scale. But then we run into things like, trees. And, I'm not for a minute saying that trees sit around thinking, but why not? I mean, does a fish think at least at some level? Does a worm think at some level? I don't know. And I think part of the problem is that we start at the top. We start with our own mind, and then we project outward. We say, okay, sure, an ape probably has consciousness. A raven sort of seems to. And we're going from the top down. But what if we go from the bottom up? And this gets weird and spooky. But the idea is, what if consciousness is just a property? It's just a property of matter or a property of something. And different things exhibit consciousness to different extents. Now, this is subject to very simple silliness, right? Like if you take a rock and you say, okay, what's it like to be a rock? Well, if I break the rock in two, which half gets the consciousness, right? You know, it's a very easily criticized and poked fun at. But you know, we don't have that problem with mass. If you have a 1 kilogram rock and you break it, you know, part of it's on this side, part of it's on that other side. It's not really a problem. The real problem is what causes consciousness to clump together into discrete units. Also, this idea of consciousness as a property, sometimes people think, ah, you're arguing for a universal mind. Well, no, not really. I'm not arguing for a universal mass, right? The point is not a universal consciousness or the universal consciousness, but simply consciousness as a property of existence that somehow gets manifested in different scenarios. And why? You know, why does it get manifested in my body, in my brain, but not in some other thing? And this is the hard problem of consciousness. Where does consciousness come from? What causes it to manifest in a human body? What are the limits of consciousness? Something seems to cause consciousness to clump into little discrete units, and brains seem to have something to do with that, right? But we don't really know the answer to that question. We don't know why a brain or a body is conscious. We know that it has a whole lot to do with my body. If the anesthesiologist gives me certain chemicals, then my consciousness turns off, right? So clearly, it has a lot to do with a body. Also, there's no evidence of people being able to extend their consciousness, like read somebody else's mind or, you know, lift a stone with their mind or any of these other kinds of spooky weirdo things. So the point is not that, you know, there's this wooey consciousness thing that we can, that it's real, the whole world is conscious and we have to tap into it. That's not the point at all. The point is that there's some mystery about consciousness. And we're not sure exactly where it lives. It lives in our bodies for sure. It seems to live in apes and pigs and ravens and dogs to some extent. But is it possible that it's also in other distributed things? Like to some weird extent in a mycelial network. I don't know. I really don't know. And I have no, haven't the foggiest idea what such a consciousness would even be like. Okay. All right. So set all that stuff aside for a minute. Now let's talk about morality. When people ask, can you be good without God? What they're asking is whether there needs to be an external, independent definition of good. They're not saying, can an atheist do good things? Obviously, you know, people who believe, people who don't believe can be just as good and just as bad. Personally, I think everybody's a rotten bastard. And the question is, can anybody be good at all? But the question, can people be good without God, is really a question of, is there an independent definition of good? And to kind of illustrate this, I want to talk about wolves. Not that I'm an expert on wolves, but imagine we're in North America 30,000 years ago. There are no humans on the continent, and there are wolves. Now, wolves have pack behavior. They have certain things that they do. Apparently, wolves mate for life. When they fight, generally speaking, they don't kill one another. The wolf that's losing exposes its neck to the wolf that's winning, and the wolf that's winning doesn't kill it. There are certain rules about how to deal with sick wolves and injured wolves. There's pack behavior, right? There's the alpha dog. There's different things, the way a wolf behaves. Now, could we say that there's a good wolf? Well, sure, because there's this pack behavior that's expected of the wolves. And that's what it means to be good. If you break those rules, you're not a good wolf. So I don't think anybody posits religion among wolves. It's just the idea that here's this behavior that's good for wolves. And you have the alpha dog in the pack. He's the leader. Everybody looks up to the alpha dog. He's what everybody follows. Now, let's think about this for a little bit. What is this ethic, this wolf ethic that lives in the wolf pack? Well, the best explanation, I think, is Richard Dawkins and his idea of a meme, that it's like a gene, except instead of being a physical, biological thing, it's a concept. And it's a concept that works well for the wolves. You know, wolves, if they behave this way, have done well, they've competed well, they've survived, so it survives. Well, that's almost an explanation. It's not quite an explanation, because you still have to ask the question, where is it? What is it? What kind of existence does it have? Is it, you know, we have this strange problem of behavior and biology, right? That certain biological realities lead to certain kinds of behaviors. You know, certain breeds of dogs like to swim, certain breeds of dogs don't like to swim. There's clearly some sort of relationship between biology and behavior. So is it just some collection of biological facts that we can intellectually organize into this thing called a meme? And that's all it is? Probably. That's probably right. You know, I'm not saying it has some spooky existence outside of that. It's not an egregore or any of those other weird things. It's this concept that somehow grows out of the biology of the wolves. But it's interesting to reflect on what exactly it is. And because, you know, if you say something exists, and this clearly exists, but what kind of existence does it have? What does that mean for it to exist? What is it? And that's where we get into these weird things called archetypes, where a dog might look up to a particular dog as the alpha dog in my pack. But, well, you know, let's take that concept and transfer it over into humans, because dogs, you know, I don't think they lay around at night looking up at the sky thinking, gee, how come my alpha dog is such a jerk? But humans do. We have similar sorts of patterns and things going on in our brains, but we sit around and we think about them. So when we see that our king is not as good a king as he ought to be, we have sort of the real king, but then we have the concept of the king, which is this archetype, right? And the real king matches that archetype to some extent or not. So the real king, the archetype is sort of like the combination of all the best qualities of all these real kings thrown into the ideal king. And we create this concept of the king. And again, you have to ask yourself, well, where does that live? Because the wolf archetype is just some collection of behavior that comes out of their genes. But this archetype, this model of the perfect king, there has never been a perfect king. So it's not part of our genes. It's some elaboration, some additional thing. It's something that we imagine. It's some bigger thing. Again, once again, you have to ask yourself, what exactly is that? And when you think about that concept of an archetype of the perfect king, the perfect queen, the perfect father, the perfect mother, all these different archetypes, all these archetypes start to take on a collective concept. Here, you not only have the archetype of the king and the queen and the father and the mother and the whatever, now you start to put them all together. So you have this collection of archetypes, almost the perfect society or something, the perfect set of rules that govern all archetypes and all rules. And that, in a way, is religion, right? I mean, religion is this collection of all these different roles and archetypes and how they interact and how they intersect and what one does and what another one does. So if you think of things that way, it's kind of hard to be against religion. Religion seems like an inevitable, necessary part of human culture. That doesn't mean that it's, that doesn't say that anything is true. But then once again, what does that mean, true? In this sense, if you have the archetype of the perfect king, is it true? Is that true? Is that something where you could say that it's true or not true? Or that it exists or doesn't exist? Do those words even work? Right? So you have this weird concept of these archetypes and the interaction of archetypes and how they all fit together. And that seems to be kind of the basis of religion. And I'll leave it at that.